was published 25 years ago, and his third, Cloud Atlas, made his name around the world and later became a Hollywood film. It follows six interlocking lives in an ambitious narrative that circles the globe and travels through time from 19th century New Zealand to a post-apocalyptic future in Hawaii and back again. Closer to home, he drew on his own childhood in Worcestershire in his coming-of-age tale Black Swan Green, about a teenager attempting to overcome a stammer and negotiate playground hierarchies, all against the backdrop of the Falklands War. His most recent novel, Utopia Avenue, charts the rise of an imaginary rock band in the late 1960s. David, when talking about that book, you've referred to the maxim that writing about music is like dancing about architecture. Well, together, we'll try to find the right words, the right formula to discuss the works that you have chosen today, because they include Debussy, Rimsky-Korsakov, Hildegard von Bingen. But first, Sibelius.
Andante Festivo. I first heard it 20-plus years ago or so in Hiroshima, played by an amateur orchestra. It was pretty much the first orchestral performance I'd gone to. Therefore, this was pretty much the first time I'd been in the room when 100 musicians all at once do that thing. The conductor stands up. This was my baptism, really. And this sound just erupted from around me. However good your speakers are at home, however great the recording, it can't really prepare you for being in that sea of sound that you become a part of, just the vibrations in the air.
The tactile sense of the bow hitting the string.
For sure, for sure. And the tactile sense of the sound waves going into and through your body, you kind of vibrate with it. I never experienced anything like it, and the memory is still precious, and its colours have not faded.
Thank you. Oh, wow.
There's a thing in the Scandinavian arts, I think, where melancholia gets merged with transcendence, and that's an intoxicating cocktail for me. There were times when that veers a little bit towards the kitsch, but then it's pulled back quite sharply into something richer and stranger and just beautiful.
And I can imagine those double basses going right through your body.
Yeah, they fill me with an urge to air conduct. I mean, heaven knows I'm not a conductor, never would be in this lifetime nor the next. But you know how some pieces of music just, they have an effect on your anatomy. Certain drum breaks or certain guitar solos. But this makes you want to stand up and air conduct.
Did you say you heard that in Hiroshima?
Yeah, yeah.
That must have been doubly moving somehow to hear that music in that place.
Yes, Hiroshima is more than a metonym for nuclear destruction, but it is also that, and it's sort of there in the pentimento of the place. It's rarely there unless you go to the museum or walk through the Peace Park, but it's also never quite not there.
Yeah. So that probably opened your body to these vibrations still more.
It's an attractive theory that I am happy to incorporate.
We heard Andante Festivo by Sibelius, performed by the Lahti Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska. You were born in Southport, David Mitchell, but grew up in Worcester. How was your early life? Your parents were both artists, so I'm sure it was colourful.
They were artists, are artists, technically, but they were working-class kids, first of their family, post-war, to sort of use talent and to use the opportunities that were in society at that time, to old-fashioned words, but to climb up the class ladder. But it wasn't a bohemian, hash-smoking background that your parents were artists might bring to mind. It was a ordinary, hard-working family, as the phraseology goes these days. My mum, mostly at home, she was a floral graphic artist. She did lots of designs for greetings cards. So my memory of her when I was a kid was her at home in her studio, bent over a drawing board, usually Radio 4 on in the background, with a vase of flowers in front of her, needing to capture that in watercolour. She's great, by the way. She's a great watercolourist, but she had to get that before the flowers wilted. So there was always that ticking clock. My dad went out and came back like a regular dad. He was a designer at the old Royal Worcester Porcelain Works in Worcester. It wasn't your parents are artists kind of childhood, but it was a childhood, but almost inadvertently. They were proving each and every day that a facility with the arts, what our neighbours would fondly call a gift, as in, oh, it must be great to have a gift. She had that a lot. But joking aside, they were proving that they could turn that into a means of earning a livelihood. And I think that's what they passed on to me.
And was there music in your life at that point?
We're in the 70s, early 80s, so music through the radio. And then as I became a teenager, got a part-time job, started flexing my fledgling financial muscles, buying cassettes, recording things off the radio, and starting to kind of plot my LP birthday Christmas money.
But you have recently learned to play instruments, haven't you?
Well, I took some piano and guitar lessons so I could understand about those instruments what the characters in my last book, Utopia Avenue, who are also musicians, I needed to know what they know about music, or at least enough to be able to bluff it.
And what did you discover as you learnt? I mean, obviously you discover what you can't do when you're at that stage.
Very quickly. If Tanya, my piano teacher in West Cork, is listening to this, she might be rolling her eyes at the ceiling about what an undisciplined student I was. Just what I learnt was the wordless pleasure that you can get picking out thirds and fifths and just playing on the keyboard. You just press your fingers and these sounds come out of that magic box. And especially with the piano, you don't even need any skill to make the sounds. Unlike flute, violin, where you need to put in hours and hours before you get even one nice note out of it. With the piano, you can just sit down, open the lid and start.
You can create sort of sound sculptures by improvising, can't you?
Yes, And the joy you get from that is like no other form of joy. It's just beautiful to do it. So that was my main discovery.
Well, we're going to hear some virtuoso piano playing in a moment in The Flight of the Bumblebee by Rimsky-Korsakov. But David, you want to, and I'm really happy about this, to experiment a little bit with the programme today and play some pieces back to back. Tell us about the first of the two we're about to hear.
It was served up for me in my weekly Spotify list. You've liked that, so you might like this. Those lists are pretty hit and miss, but it's called In Memory of a Honeybee. I instantly thought, wow, that is beautiful. And it's just so bee-like. You know how life's made up of these daft little stories? There's one that is somehow encased in this In Memory of a Honeybee. A few years ago, my wife was flying off to Japan. She was on her way out of the house when she saw this little honeybee just lying on the patio, literally between the front door and the taxi. And so she held the taxi up, got a leaf, put the bee in a jar and went off. And on the way to the airport, she texted me very firm, strict instructions on how to bring this honeybee back to life. It wasn't dead. It was just sort of resting or just ill. And it's somehow so her to be really worried about the well-being of this bee. She texted me when she was in Japan to ask about the bee. I have to do what she says because she'll know if I lie. So I had to follow the instructions to the letter. And I'm happy to report that 2-3 days later on this diet of honey water or whatever it was my wife told me to do, the bee
rose up
on the third day from bee purgatory and flew off. And we like to think that every subsequent bee might be a distant relative of the bee she saved that time.
And that every taste of honey came possibly from a relative of that bee.
Who knows? Everything's connected. I learned that trick from Late Junction here on Radio 3, how when you play pieces of music back to back, the first one bleeds into the next one, like colours bleed into each other. Or when you put a big band of orange next to a big band of green, there's this black line between them that somehow is made by your eyeball and the brain.
Rothko-like.
Rothko-like, yes. And even as a teenager, when you're making mixtapes to impress your friends, I used to really enjoy thinking how this track will sound after the one before.
So you're a would-be DJ, really?
Oh, yes, yes. I'd love your job. I'd really love your job.
We heard Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee, performed by Adam Jurge. And before that, in memory of a honeybee, an extraordinary piece, composed and performed by Felix Rösch and Martina Sternischer with the Mondaina Quartet. Is it true, David Mitchell, that you secretly wrote poems as a child?
Yes, I did. I'm sure it's not a vice that is exclusive to word nerd, imaginative teenagers. I'm sure it still goes on.
I came across some of mine and I was appalled.
Yeah. Well, you're lucky it wasn't put on the internet
before. God forbid.
It's a healthy stage to go through, though, don't you think?
Yeah. All that teenage angst.
It has to go somewhere. Why not into atrocious poetry?
Did you have a nom de plume?
Well, I did, and I wouldn't mention it, but there's someone out on the internet who knows it. Anyway, I am blushing. Let the record show I am blushing, but I thought it would be really cool to have as my nom de plume, James Bolivar. There you go.
Absolutely.
I just like how it sounded revolutionary.
And perhaps more pertinently, James, sorry, David.
Yeah, very funny.
You also used to create elaborate maps, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I was a low-maintenance kid in some respects. To get me through the half term, my mum was a watercolourist, so around the house were these big, big drawing boards, and she'd mount a piece of beautiful, lush cartridge paper on a thick wooden drawing board for me, and I would do pound shop rip-offs of Tolkien's Middle Earth and Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea and think about geography and the names of these places and who was like to live there. Were they rip-off hobbits or rip-off orcs or rip-off elves? And I think of those as my first exercises in world building. And that is a part of what you need to do as a novelist.
Well, talking of maps, you're going to take us now to Peru in the 17th century, aren't you?
Yes. I've always been fascinated by syncretic Christianity, the way that one religion will go out and absorb what was already there into itself, and how this sits in conversations about authenticity and appropriation. It looks like a one-way street, but how maybe it's a two-way street, about how maybe the religion, in this case, of the occupied, of the decimated, also is co-opting the religion of the incomers. And this conversation is somehow in this austere, beautiful piece of music. I like to imagine the first Spanish-style cathedral in Latin America just resonating and booming with this piece of music.
What we're going to hear is Hanak Pachap, Kusi Kuinen.
Well done.
It's a processional hymn to the Virgin Mary, composed by an Inca student of Juan Pérez de Bocanegra. He was a Franciscan priest. It was published in 1631, making it, actually, about the earliest work of vocal polyphony printed in the New World.
Thank you.
drums or something, aren't they? That relentless, marching, cathedral-filling, whacked drum. It's quite a piece.
We heard Hanak Pachap Kusi Kwinan, a processional hymn to the Virgin Mary in the Quechua language, performed by soprano Grace Davidson, ex-cathedra, and conducted by Geoffrey Skidmore. You studied English and American literature at the University of Kent, David Mitchell. I wonder how good a literature degree is as a training for a novelist.
Accidentally, I think it was probably the best thing I could have done. I did English because I didn't know what else to do, but I wanted to go to college, and the world of work was looking pretty scary at 18, and all my friends were going to college too. And I didn't think I was much of a scholar, but I did value the opportunity to, even in my embryonic way, to think about plot and character and world building and style and structure. I'd read the Canterbury Tales and just think, wow, that's just the juxtaposition of the formal, the informal, the knightly and the vulgar, just rammed up next to each other. I was learning all sorts of things that now I can identify because I like to do them, but I was encountering them for the first time there. So it was actually the best thing I could have done.
Actually, our theme tune comes from incidental music written for Canterbury Tales, music from Chaucer. And there's a wonderful line in it, which I know you'll savour, which is, "Vile brass emanating from the devil's arse."
I think it's the Friar's Tale or the Summoner's Tale, because they hate each other. I think it is the Summoner's Tale, where the narrator goes down to hell and looks for all the friars and says, well, I know they're here somewhere. Where are the friars? And the guide says, well, let's lift the devil's tail, shall we? And have a look up the devil's arse. And they all come out like this little cloud. And then they go back in again. You really may need to cut that. I'm sorry. This is not very radiantly at all. But maybe it is.
I suspect they'll love it. You worked in a bookshop for a while, then went to Sicily to teach English as a foreign language. You mentioned Japan, which you went to subsequently, again teaching. And this was really important for you in lots of ways, personal and in terms of influence. Tell me a little bit about the house that you lived in, which I think was just outside Hiroshima.
The way of describing it, it seems as if I planned my life really well. It really wasn't. I really didn't. It was just rolls of dice, who I met, conversations I had, and they set me off on one particular route rather than another. But my second year in Japan, I was living in a tumble-down, two-storey house, backing onto some rice fields, backing onto the river. And I'm not really a mind-body-spirit kind of person, but my ghost story, insofar as it is a ghost story, happened there. I was in this old house by the river in August 1945, when the bomb was dropped. Many of the half-survivors who survived the blast, but I'm afraid weren't going to survive for very long, they walked north along the river, away from the city, to the area where I was living. And locals would say it's quite a membrane between this world and the next. Is that? It's only a membrane. I never really gave that much consideration until one night I woke up in the dark, unable to move. There's a verb for this in Japanese because it happens a lot, but unable to move. And there was someone standing at the end of my bed wanting to know what I was doing in his house. I'm pretty sure it was him. And in my not very good Japanese, I explained who I was. I didn't open my eyes because I was afraid if I did, what I saw would be something that I wished I could forget. I now wish I had opened my eyes, but hey, I was 26, 27 at the time, and I didn't then. So I just explained that I'd just be there for a short time. I was renting the house. I was there for a year, and I hope this was okay with this entity. And I just felt this sort of, yeah, okay, yeah, fine, I understand. And the entity kind of faded away, and I could move my arms and my legs again. It only happened once, and I'm still not really sure if it's sort of hardcore evidence of ghosts and of life after death. But that's my ghost story. And as you can see, I remember every single detail of it.
What was the verb in Japanese? I'd like to hear the sound of it.
For spirit, we have yule, and the verb is at the end. We have yule ni shibalalete.
Shibalalete, that's very musical.
Shibalalete. Yes, it is.
And you met your wife in Japan.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Yes. Yeah, we were both teachers in a language school there, and we began courting, as our grandparents would have called it. And one thing led to another, and here we are, quite a few years later.
It was at Hiroshima University where you were working that you started writing?
Yes, it was. I came across a piece of advice or maybe an observation when I was there, which was lots of people have talent, but that's not enough. You need to combine it with discipline. And that just found me at the right time. So I acted on it. I had this wish or this compulsion or this desire to write. Maybe more than that, it was a dissatisfaction if I didn't write. So relatively easy in that pre-internet world, I stopped going out. And I got rid of my TV and I'd come home from work and I'd just work on something. It was a not very good novel, but I wanted to go from being a person who was working on a novel, I knew quite a few of them, into a person who had finished one. And that really was my creative writing workshop. What I wrote was rubbish, pretty much, but there were bits in it that weren't rubbish. Sent it off to a group of agents in London, heard back from pretty much none of them, quite rightly, and just one or two, though. I got an encouraging, well, not this one, but let's see the next thing you write. And the next thing I wrote was Ghostwritten. So that would be my piece of advice to aspiring writers and composers. It's not enough to be talented. You have to discipline that.
Yes, it comes down to advice I got, which was, look, having ideas is quite easy. It's what you do with them that makes the difference. And that can be hard work.
It is hard work. It should be hard work. Mm. That's why it's art. You spend your life learning to fail better. Thank you, Mr. Beckett, at that. Mm. But that's also why it's great, isn't it? Mm.
The next piece of music you heard in Hiroshima as well, I think. What is it that you particularly love about this?
Oh, Appalachia Waltz, yeah. Composed by Mark O'Connor, performed by Yo-Yo Ma. Something about the solo cello, it never outstays its welcome. I can listen to it for hours. And what is it about it? It's somehow the sound of mountains breathing.
Thank you.
it almost defies belief that one solo cellist can do all that. You could swear there's two or even three of them at it. It's a virtuosic thing, isn't it?
Well, he's doing exactly, Mark O'Connell, the composer, what Bach did, of course, which is using the open strings and treble stopping the strings so that you get harmony on what is normally a monodic instrument.
As a non-musician, I can only shake my head in happy disbelief and say, wow, that is so cool.
We heard Appalachia Waltz, composed by Mark O'Connor and performed by Yo-Yo Ma. Your first published novel, which you mentioned, Ghostwritten, won the John Llewellyn Rees Prize. It's written in a series of changing first-person perspectives, but all interlinked, rather like music, of course. That seems to be a theme in your novels, which is why you're an ideal guest for Private Passions, the interconnectedness of things.
My kind of home length of narrative is about 10,000 words, about 30 pages. That's sort of the Lego block that I most naturally like to build, which is kind of problematic because it's a bit too long to be a short story, a bit too short to be a novella. It hasn't even got a name, really, other than long short story. However, it's long enough to begin to feel invested in what's going on, but short enough to sort of have the getaway car of brevity from the cops of tedium. You're out of there before you outstay your welcome. So really my novels are made of these blocks. They are novels, but they're kind of assemblages of smaller narratives as well.
The characters also, rather like leitmotifs in music, appear again, don't they, in subsequent novels. Are you creating a kind of Little Mitchell universe in which these people reside?
Little Mitchell universe? How dare you, sir? How dare you, sir? yes, I am. I didn't mean to when I started out. I did it just because it's cool. Just that impulse, I think, is a valid artistic propulsive form. I want to do that because it's cool. I want to try that because I haven't seen anyone do this before. It's just cool.
The next piece is composed by Johnny Flynn, who was recently on this programme.
Oh, was he? Oh, wow. I envy you that. Well, it is indescribably beautiful, so I won't even try. But do keep an ear out for the bridge. Now the land that I know is a dream, and the line in the distant grows faint. So wide is my river, the horizon a sliver. The artist has run out of paint.
Stars and the song in my heart is a tune for the journeyman's tale. The water sustains me without even trying. The water can't drown me, and I'm done distance grows faint. So wide is my river, the horizon a sliver, the artist has run out of pain. Where the blue of the sea meets the sky, and the big yellow sun leads me home. Breath by and by, the water sustains me without even trying. The water can't drown me, I'm down with my
killer song. Isn't that great? It makes me think of Wind in the Willows, Huckleberry Finn, Mill on the Floss, the skating scene from Philippa Pierce's Tom's Midnight Garden, if you grew up in the same era of books as me, Joni Mitchell's song, River even. There's just, oh, I do love a good river in a song.
The Water, written and performed by the multifaceted Johnny Flynn with Laura Marling. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the prize-winning writer David Mitchell. David, Cloud Atlas was published in 2004, a captivating meditation on power and what it does to human beings. One of the stories is about a young musician, Robert Frobisher, who heads to Belgium to work as an assistant to an ailing English composer, Vivian Ayres.
Yes, yes. I just found Eric Fenby's memoir, Delius As I Knew Him. He, as you will know, was Frederick Delius's amanuensis. Great narrative. Ken Russell also fell under its spell and filmed it. There was so much in it that is it theft? Is it appropriation? I'm not sure.
Stravinsky said, bad composers borrow, good composers steal.
That reminds me a lot of Truman Capote's version on the same thing, which was, I don't plagiarise, I steal. Yeah. That's the same sort of thing.
What were you keen to explore with these characters?
Creativity. My composer characters, I was a little shy and nervous of writing about a writer. Looking back, I think I was also just really curious about music. What is it about vibrations in the air that can do this to people? That's all they are, but they generate emotions. They can make the hairs on your arm rise up. It's not real. It's just vibrations in the air. How come? That's a question that I've always been fascinated by. I'll never finish answering. That's why it's a great question, but I do like to explore it. Maybe it's envy as well. I think, secretly or not so secretly, us writers envy you lot. We envy musicians who can just, especially in a live context, you get to see your art consumed in real time by an audience as it's happening. A feedback loop gets set up between the musicians on a stage and the audience listening to it. And wow, writers envy that. We make our art alone in little rooms, months and months and months, not having conversations with real people, but with imaginary people.
The film of the book, starring Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, amongst others, was released in 2012. How was it seeing your story come alive on the screen? Because in some ways it sounds almost unfilmable.
It's easily my most unfilmable book and is the only one of my books that's ever been filmed, which is a testament to the Wachowski siblings and Tom Tick for the directors. There is no kick like hearing words that you've written in your back bedroom in your little house in Hiroshima or Ledbury, I think I wrote parts of Cloud Atlas in the mouths of some of the most famous actors on the planet. Tom Hanks, for example. That stays with you forever. That never fades, that one.
As you said, the film's directed by the Wachowskis, and you've done several other screenwriting projects with them since, haven't you? Matrix 4, for example.
Yes. It's instructive to learn how to think like a screenwriter for me as a novelist. As a team, I've really enjoyed my forays into that world, the economy with which they have to think because it's just so expensive. And their approach to narrative and structure and pacing, character, and also just the fact they have actors. The biggest challenge I've had is to not overwrite a director I'm working with at the moment. We have something that's almost a mantra, which is just let the actors decide. And just to cede that control has been tricky, but also instructive and fun.
You've described your magpie-like search for new musical experiences. Do you actively search for certain things?
That magpie joy was a real joy of the old record shops, and it's never really been replaced. But at some level, I'm still that person flicking through. You know, your hands and your fingers and your dominant hand, I can still feel how the plastic sleeves that the LPs were put into and the updraft, that waft of air that you got on your face as you were hunched over, working through the stock, hunting things down and finding rare records you didn't know existed and finding things you've never heard of, but just somehow liking the look of them, reading the semiotics of the cover. Might this font be talking to you in a particular way? This sort of acid jazz fusion artwork, might this be giving you a clue that you're going to like what's wrapped up inside it? I do miss those days.
Well, we've got another pairing coming up now, both inspired by the Greek myth of Eurydice.
You said I could have something from a musical. I don't know much about musicals, but my daughter does. And we were in Okinawa a few weeks ago, and she said, Hades Town, Dad, you've got to listen to this. Both the music and the narrative are extraordinary. It's quite a lot of musicals can do one, but not the other. But I've learned to trust my daughter's judgment, so I listened to the whole thing. And this indeed is a highlight. And bouncing off that into a composition by Christoph Gluck, originally transcribed by James Rhodes onto solo piano. Isn't it great how myths can transcend the form they were born into and be translated into other contexts and survive that transition? Like the great American songbook songs, they can be done by anyone and they're still going to sound pretty good. These, I think, are pieces of music that are more than merely pretty good.
Gonna break their banks for us, and with their gold be generous. All the fashion in the pan, all to fashion for your hand. The river's gonna give us the red dance.
Lover, tell me if you're able, who's gonna lay the wedding table? Times being what they are.
Sing along, and they're gonna bend their branches down to lay their fruit upon the ground, the almond and the apple, and the sugar from the maple. The tree's gonna lay the wedding table.
When you sing your song, the one you're working on, spring will come again.
Yes.
Why don't you sing it then?
It isn't finished.
Sing it. You want to take me home?
Yes.
Sing the song.
Love.
How'd you do that?
I don't know. The song's not finished, though.
Even so, it can do this?
I know.
You have to finish it.
Lover, tell me when we'll wed. Who's gonna make the wedding there? Times being what they are, hard and getting harder all the time.
Lover, when I sing my song, all the birds gonna sing along, and they'll come flying from all around. Lay their feathers on the ground, and we'll lie down and hide it down. A pillow needs our heads. The bird's gonna make the wedding bed.
And the tree's gonna lay the wedding table.
And the river's gonna give us the wedding band.
Thank you.
I love in the last piece the way that the piano seems to me to capture light on water. It shimmers and refracts and reflects. I love that. And a joy of musicals is the way that you are likely to hear combinations of words that you've certainly never heard rhymed before. And you suspect maybe no one's ever rhymed before. The rivers are going to break their banks for us and with their gold be generous. It's just this little buzz of, oh, nice one, when you hear words you've never heard rhymed before. Yeah.
We heard James Rhodes playing the melody by Christoph Gluck, which was arranged by Giovanni Scambati, from what we would call the opera Orfeo ed Eurydice. And before that, we heard Eurydice in Hadestown, composed by Anaïs Mitchell, no relation. And performed by the original Broadway cast. Would you like to write a musical?
I would be cautious of doing so, but yes, given time, given the right context, I think it would be a pretty glorious challenge.
After all, you've written for the stage with two librettos, as it were. Did you enjoy working with a composer?
Oh, very much so. Really, I think my book, Utopia Avenue, came out of that experience. I'm a word nerd. Composers are music nerds. And it's the age of the nerds. Nothing wrong in being a nerd. Just working with anyone is nice, actually. It's part of the pleasure I get from my work in screenwriting.
You've also collaborated with your wife, K.A. Yoshida, on the translation from Japanese of two autism memoirs. Why is that important?
Well, in the first instance, because our son has autism. And like Naoki Higashida, the author of these books, he's nonverbal. So it was, when he was a kid, very, very difficult to the point of being impossible to know what was happening in his head, as he wasn't able to tell us. But when my wife first found Naoki's first book, The Reason I Jump, she just ordered it from Japan and immediately began translating things over the kitchen table. And it just made a lot of sense. It was like a sort of Rosetta Stone for autism in some ways, at least for our son's autism, the way the condition presents in him, or that sort of mental architecture. And so we translated it initially just so that people who work with our son could read it too and know what it was teaching us, because it was a bit of a game changer for us. It's a sort of fervent manifesto to assume competence that I'm afraid I feel guilty about it now, but I wasn't doing in the early years. So when my agent got to hear about it, he said, well, could I have a look? And he said, we really need to roll this out. I think there's a much bigger audience for it. And to my great joy, it's now translated into more languages than I am. And its author at that time became a taxpayer, which is any parent of any kid with special needs would agree. I think that's what you want most.
And do you feel you know now more, or is he able to communicate more what's going on in his head?
Somewhat more. He's still largely nonverbal. Autism's a mystery inside an enigma. Certitude can sometimes be a little bit of an enemy. You sort of need to live with the fact that you might not be understanding what's going on and to keep that possibility open. But yes, he's now a late teenager, and so his arsenal of ways to communicate has grown. And we've sort of maybe become more receptive, in part because of Naoki's books.
A meditative piece next.
What have we got next? Peace, composed and performed by Bill Evans. My wife put me onto this, actually, in our early days. As you say, it's contemplative, and somehow it captures this elusive beastie we call peace. It's a word that comes with a lot of baggage. The thing in that baggage I like most of all is just sharing a really nice afternoon with someone you love without, I hope this won't sound trite, but without the leader of a neighbouring state deciding that it is suitable to destroy what you have, to destroy everybody's peaceful Sunday afternoons with drones and illegal invasions. Thank you. The right hand has the joy and insanity and chaos and sort of jangling hithery, thithery, not knowing what it's going to do next quality of the world. And the left hand, the whole way through, it's there now, hush now, there now, hush now. What a beautiful composition that is.
Perfect description. Peace, Peace, which was composed and performed there by the great Bill Evans. For your last novel, David Mitchell, Utopia Avenue, you wrote about a fictitious band in the late 60s. In fact, some reviewers found it so convincing that they thought Utopia Avenue was a real band.
Yeah, those are my favourite reviews.
You must have been delighted by that. What were some of the challenges of writing about music, in fact?
Very simply, books don't have speakers. You can't hear it. If you're writing for film, then you can have the music there to show what you want the reader slash viewer to believe in and get excited about. With text on the page, it is lousy at reproducing music. You can't really do it. So the fix there is to show what the music does to people. This is the strong suit of the novel. This is the strong suit of fiction and text on the page. It's very good at representing emotion.
I would say that there was an element of Debussy in Bill Evans's Peace, Peace. Debussy is one of the great cool characters music.
Very
and
cool.
Particularly his La Mer. And the sea is important to you, isn't it, living in West Cork in Ireland?
Yeah. The sea is important to human beings. We are
the rhythm of
water.
Life.
The river of life. It's a ready-made metaphor for cosmic indifference and many, many things. And in Debussy's sea, it contains many of the seas that the seas can be. It's placid and quiet and ominous and sinister and green and glassy and brown and grey and terrifying and magnificent. And at the end of this movement, where the crescendo comes up, you just think, how did you do that? How do you make an orchestra turn into the sea? That should be impossible. Yet here you are doing the impossible.
And actually, there's an extraordinary connection to your experiences in that Debussy put on the cover of the score, or his publisher did, a hokusai picture of the wave. And if you open the score, it looks like this, the way he writes it. And that's how he did what you're asking. In other words, when you look at the notes, you can see how he got this feeling of absolutely inevitable momentum. the end of the first movement of Debussy's La Mer, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by François-Xavier Roth. We're going to end, rather reluctantly, I have to say, David, with a final pairing, beginning with the Corpus Christi carol, marvellously sung by Jeff Buckley. How does he get up there? Why that? And then a piece of Hildegard von Bingen.
Why that? Because it's beautiful. Because I think of the layers. It's a glass darkly we're looking through. The lyrics evoke a kind of ancient, misty Arthurian England that never was, as seen from the perspective of the high Middle Ages, early modern era, as seen by someone with a dad, Tim Buckley, in 60s counterculture music, and Jeff then as a sort of late 80s, early 90s indie scene rock singer, but so much more than that. I like these layers. I like the schmooshing together of them, like all the ingredients in a naked bar, you know, those really healthy ones. It just kind of gets schmooshed in. And plus, of course, I guess the tragedy of Jeff Buckley's early death. It's sung by a ghost in a way. There's nothing like it.
There's so many things, as you say, that feed into this. It's actually an anonymous tune which has been arranged by Benjamin Britten, performed, as you say, by Jeff Buckley from his album Grace. And then that'll lead in to the first real woman composer.
Yes, my list needed some female energy, and where better to get this female energy from than Canon's first female composer? This just feels so fresh and vivid and, again, in some ways, oddly contemporary. It's incredible to think that a woman in the 12th century, such a male-dominated, theocratic world, could navigate that world and bloom in it and produce this imperishable art and beat it at its own game. This is a religious song about how God was also a woman in and through the Virgin Mary. There's something really special with this.
Quia Ergo Femina by Hildegard von Bingen will be performed by Barbara Thornton of the Sequential Ensemble for Early Music. But first, we'll hear that wonderful Corpus Christi by Jeff Buckley. So, David Mitchell, thank you so much.
Michael, I've had a wonderful time. Thanks for having me.
Storm, Corpus Christi, it Ergo Femina by Hildegard of Bingen, sung by Barbara Thornton. And before it, the Corpus Christi Carol from Jeff Buckley's album Grace. And those were the final choices of Michael Barclay's guest on today's Private Passions, the author David Mitchell. Next week at the same time, Michael will be talking to the leading forensic scientist, Professor Sue Black.
The year 1904. The critic, Oscar Schmidt, and the accusation that England was the land without music.
I don't think it was true then. I don't think it's true now.
After a year of cuts and crises, what's the place of classical music in the UK today?
Particularly music, and particularly classical music, has been degraded, dismissed.
I have to give you a quote which I read recently. Art is the highest form of hope.
I mean, the music community at the moment, I would say, feels rather fragile.
The Land Without Music with Richard Morrison. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello from me, John Shea. I'm here with you for the rest of the day. And today is the first Sunday of our new look schedule. So, some new times for us all to get used to, but a couple of programmes that aren't moving around are Choral Evensong at 3 o'clock, followed by Jazz Record Requests. Alan Shepton is here with that, as ever, at 4. 5 o'clock is the new time for the Early Music Show, and today Anna French will be introducing Radio 3's recently inaugurated new generation baroque ensemble, Ensemble Argiletti. After that, Words and Music moves to 6 o'clock, and then Neil Brand celebrates 100 years of MGM, the film studio that produced some of the greatest musicals of all time. That's in our Sunday feature at 7:15 this evening. Right now, it's 1:30, time for one of our new programmes, and someone would like to take us all on a musical journey.
Hello, I'm Sarah Moore-Peach, and this is BBC Radio 3's Music Map, a brand new show for Sunday afternoons where we'll explore a piece of classical music by mapping it, not with our minds, but with our ears, locating it within a rich musical landscape. And our destination today is this. This is Claude Debussy's Prélude à l'après-midi d'un faune, the prelude to the afternoon of a faun. The conductor of this recording, Pierre Boulez, described it as the beginning of modern music. I think when most of us listen to music, we don't do it in a linear or logical way. Our ears reach forwards and backwards in time. As we listen, our brains fire off in all directions, making connections that help us locate ourselves and the music. Sound triggers memories, and each time we hear a particular piece of music, it's a fresh experience coloured by so many things. How well we know the music, how we're feeling that day, what's going on in our lives. I'm not so much interested in what Debussy was trying to do when he wrote this music in 1894. I'm more intrigued by what your ears are doing when you're listening today. So over the next hour and a half, as we explore our music map, we're going to hear a bunch of other music that might just stimulate those sonic synapses and offer up a Venn diagram of sound, placing this piece inside your own musical landscape. And we'll hear Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun in full at the end of today's show. OK, let's start by setting the scene with another French pastoral, and a warm breeze is on the air in this music by Jean-Philippe Rameau.